That Dominic Sambrick was, of course, a didgeridoo, signalling the fact that we have reached part two of
our
survey.
Welcome back to Australia.
Our survey of Aussie PMs. And Dominic, in the first episode, we got to 1966, hadn't we?
We proceeded slowly but steadily in the sort of Jeff Boycott.
Yes.
Sort of cricketing style. And we've got to the departure of Robert Menzies.
Australia's longer serving prime minister.
And so if you missed that, and we talked about Australian political culture and the different sort of forces within it and so on, and parallels of Britain and why we don't know more about it in Britain. So if you missed all that, what on earth is wrong with you? Go back and listen to the previous podcast. But we're going to kick off now with Harold Holt and one of the great stories in Australian history. So Harold Holt, Tom, you know where his ancestors were from?
Probably from Cornwall or somewhere.
They were from the great city of Birmingham.
Were they?
They were from Birmingham.
Villa fans.
I don't know if they were Villa fans. They may well have been Birmingham City, or they may have preceded the creation of those clubs. Anyway, so his ancestors are from Birmingham. He went to boarding school in Melbourne, and he had been Australia's youngest MP in the early 1930s. And he was very much a sort of protege of Menzies, I think. Right through, and he'd been a Labour. He'd had a sort of great, regarded as one of Australia's great Labour ministers. So he got on really well with the leaders of the trade unions, which is they probably were mates, and that's quite similar to British conservative politicians of the same period who also generally got on well with the trade unions until the late 1960s. So
was that the Queen always like preferring Labour prime ministers?
Labour prime ministers, exactly. And then he was treasurer, which is the equivalent of chancellor. Treasury Secretary in the United States, and was seen as, you know, good, kind of pragmatic. I mean, obviously, this is a boom time for Australia, the sort of mid-60s. Everything seems to be fine. Everything's going well. Except for Vietnam, which we'll come to. So Harold Holt becomes Prime Minister, succeeding Menzies. And Vietnam, he's very enthusiastic about Vietnam, isn't he? I mean, he something like triples Australia's troop commitment.
And he goes to the White House, doesn't he, and famously says that we're all the way with LBJ.
He says he personally is all the way with it. Because if you read the text of the speech, he basically says to Johnson in front of the whole press corps, you know, you'll have moments when you'll be doubting yourself and people are all against you, but remember there's one person who's all the way with LBJ, and that's him. Harold. I mean, he doesn't say it in that fantastic accent. He says it in his own voice. And Australians are horrified by this because they think it's terribly servile.
Yeah, it's demeaning, isn't it?
It is.
You're trying to throw off the chains of the British oppressive
throwing
state.
On the chains then, of But have you seen photos of him with LBJ? So LBJ is obviously massive, and Harold Holt is much shorter. And looks like he's having a brilliant time, but he also looks like he's LBJ's Batman.
And not in the cricketing sense.
And not in the cricketing sense. No, but they go and they get lashed by the swimming pool together at LBJ's ranch in Texas, I think. They have a great time.
LBJ had quite a kind of Australian approach to language, didn't he?
And he's quite Australian. I think he's quite an Australian figure, LBJ.
You can imagine him at the barbecue.
Definitely. I think that's what they do in Texas. They just sit around eating grilled meat, drinking beer, swimming, getting hammered, talking about how they're looking forward to their triumph in Vietnam.
And Harold Holt, of course, is a great guy for he loves the beach and he loves the good swim.
He likes
swim.
I know it's terrible. We shouldn't laugh about this.
No,
I really thought when I was looking at getting my notes and stuff, I thought we do this, we should do this at the somber tone of tragedy.
So this is just before Christmas in 1967.
Yes, it is.
So he's been Prime Minister for just over a year, and he goes for a swim off the Victorian coast,
the Cheviot Beach. Famous for its rips.
Is never seen again.
Yeah. So he vanishes. So he went with a couple of friends, didn't he?
They get picked back up, don't they? So they get back in. But he's never seen again.
And where's Harold Holt?
So the likeliest theory is that he drowned. Well, let's be honest.
Well, he drowned.
He drowned. But there is another theory that actually all along he'd been spying for the Chinese.
The Prime Minister was a Spy is the name of the book by Anthony Gray.
And that he'd been picked up by a Chinese submarine and taken to China.
So I looked into this theory. This is an absolutely...
So you don't... You're
well, let me tell you the theory. The theory is that Harold Holt was recruited as a Chinese agent as a very young man. And he originally thought he was an agent for the Kuomintang, the Chinese nationalists.
Chiang Kai-shek.
Then sometime, I think, in the 1950s or 60s, his handlers revealed to him that he was actually an agent for the communists. Holt, despite the fact that he's working for one of the most anti-communist sort of government chief executives in the in the democratic world.
So how do you think Menzies would, I mean, Menzies wouldn't like.
He'd have been very unimpressed.
He would be very unimpressed by the idea of working for Chairman Mao.
Yeah. So the claim is that Harold Holt, he got to become Prime Minister of Australia, still working for the Chinese. And then eventually the Chinese decided that he was in danger of being rumbled or something. So they sent a submarine to lurk off this beach. Harold Holt swam out to the submarine, was picked up, and spent the rest of his days very happily eating, you know, Chinese food in China. Yeah. And his wife, when she was presented with this theory, said he hated Chinese food. Yes, he hated,
which is obviously the clinching argument against it. But also, and there's another theory that he might have been murdered by the Viet Cong. So those are the three theories. He drowned.
Yeah.
He was murdered by the Viet Cong, or he was picked up by a Chinese submarine.
You know, the Chinese theory, the most fascinating thing about the Chinese theory is the man who came up with it, who's a British reporter, I think, a Reuters journalist called Anthony Gray, had himself been taken prisoner in China.
So I wonder if he'd picked up intimations.
Or had been driven mad by his incarceration.
Yes, well, that's
an alternative explanation.
Yeah, yeah. But this is still not the best detail about Harold Holt.
No, tell us the best detail, Tom.
Okay, so the best detail about Harold Holt is that the memorial to Harold Holt is a swimming centre.
Yes, it is.
So in Melbourne, the Harold Holt Memorial Swimming Centre, I believe, stands there to this day.
So the truth is they were building that swimming centre, I think, before he drowned.
And they needed a memorial.
But why on earth? I mean, it's absolutely, I've actually had a look at it online. It looks a lovely pool.
Yeah, it does.
Really nice.
It does. So,
but I wouldn't swim in it just because I think.
What, you might be picked up by a submarine?
Who wants to swim in a swimming pool that's named after a man who drowned? Madness.
It's distinctive. Yeah.
It is, but I
agree.
Mean,
it's very distinctive.
I mean, it's not like you can, it's like naming a car after Princess Diana or something. I mean, it's well, just demented.
Yes, but Dominic, perhaps it's reflective of the can-do Aussie spirit.
Maybe.
That we as Poms.
Think, as simpering, you
know,
Poms.
Yes. Whereas, you know, whinging about it.
Whereas Australians are plunging into that pool even as we speak.
Drowned? Let me get in there. Yeah. So that would be my hunch.
Okay.
Anyway, so Harold Holt has drowned and now he's swimming pool.
That's the end of
so
him.
He gets succeeded by a guy called John Gorton.
Now, he's a very good character.
He's an excellent character.
But,
and I should
but
say,
so unknown outside Australia.
Right.
I mean, he's almost French in his characterness.
Well, which is exactly how he's described by my friend Steve Kinnane, who is the ABC Europe correspondent. And
right.
So I think in the wake of the French president's episode we did, a number of Aussie followers said, please can you do one on Australian prime ministers?
And they didn't say it in that accent, Tom.
Hi, mate. Could you do Aussie prime ministers? Is what they said.
Yeah.
And I was, like you, a bit nervous about that because my knowledge of Australian politics isn't all it could be. But I was having our first cricket match of the season. I had to drive Steve down and his son, who's doing a Australian politics course. And so they told me all about it. And Steve then sent me a briefing note. And his description of John Gorton was slightly French in his lifestyle.
Slightly French.
But you know, also, as an Oxford man.
Yeah.
Gorton studied at Brasenose College and was captain of the rowing team.
Like David Cameron. He wasn't
like David Cameron.
Well,
we'll come to Cameron later because there's an interesting kind of link there. But I saw a fellow of Brasenose over the weekend, and he shall remain nameless because he's apparently, there's an anecdote that that Gorton was contacted by the principal of Brasenose to tell him he was being made an honorary fellow, which is a rare accolade. And Gorton asked if there was any money in it for him.
Really? That's pretty frank.
And then he said, please don't say this because it might be actionable. So,
all right.
I apologize.
Gorton's not still alive. I mean,
no,
he's
that's
not
true. Really. No, that's
although
true.
He died at the age of 90. So, you know.
Yeah, I think 98, wasn't he?
No, I think it's another one who's 98.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think, was it Gough?
Oh, no, that's Whitlam. It's Gough Whitlam, isn't it? Yeah.
Anyway, we'll come to Gough Whitlam later. Let's stick with Gorton because Gorton is great fun. So Gorton is a war hero.
Yes,
he had been in the Air Force, hadn't he? And he'd crashed onto an island in Indonesia. And he'd previously been quite a sort of slightly matinee idol-ish, I would say, And they have to basically, do they rebuild his face?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a terrible story because he, so this is, I think, just after Pearl Harbor, and he's essentially part of the air garrison looking after Singapore. And obviously that goes terribly wrong. And so after Singapore falls, he gets evacuated with various other Australian pilots, and they get sunk. And so he spends a day in a lifeboat surrounded by sharks, and he's narrowly avoided death twice. He gets picked up. And they have to basically rebuild his face. So he has scarring for the rest of his, life. And he then, you know, he returns to the Air Force and crashes again twice. So slightly jinxed.
Jinxed, but also lucky. I mean, you know, he could have been killed then.
Yeah. half empty, half full.
Well, actually, Tom, just before we come onto his sort of political persona, that bad luck that he had with his physical health. I mean, we think of Australians as the sort of absolute epitome of, you know, strapping good health and so on. But actually, we forgot that there was a caretaker prime minister between Harold Holt and John Gorton who had even worse luck with his health than John Gorton did. So he was a man called John McEwen, and he was only prime minister for a matter of weeks. Do you know what happened to him?
No, I've never heard of him.
So he was only really brief as prime minister. I mean, I think sort of weeks.
Because so the Lady Harold Jane Grey of Australia was.
Because after ministers. Harold Holt had drowned or been picked up by the submarine, they needed to elect a new leader. And so while that leadership election
was
happening.
So he was the interim.
He was the interim.
He was the default one.
And what happened to him? He had dermatitis so badly that he would walk around in Canberra with kind of blood seeping out of his feet. Oh. So it's a bit like me when I was
a bit
on
like you. Yes.
Except the difference is his was not a one-off. His was a serious condition. And he ended up in such pain that he starved himself to death.
Was this while he was prime minister?
No, it was 1980 though, not long afterwards, sort of 11 or 12 years afterwards.
Okay, that's tough.
That is tough.
So anyway, he was the shortest.
Well, he was the one with the worst
prime minister.
I think that's fair.
And the worst feet. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So back to Gorton.
Gorton then comes in. So Gorton is a war hero, and he is elected as the new Liberal Party leader.
He's very anti-communist, isn't he?
He's very anti-communist. But he's also, his big identity is that he is an ordinary bloke. He's a larrikin. He's plain speaking,
but also just a little bit French.
He is a bit French. So
how does his Frenchness express itself?
Well, so the first thing, he's only just been prime minister for a matter of months, isn't he? And they're because of his anti-communism, he's very committed to, you know, the alliance with the Americans, sort of the commitment to Vietnam and all that sort of stuff. And he goes to talk to the US ambassador at the US embassy, doesn't he, about Vietnam.
Well, he's been invited to go there.
Yeah, but he's been drinking.
He's been drinking. And his aide keeps saying, come on, mate, we've got to go to the US embassy. And he's, I'll just have another.
Is that how we spoke? That was very similar to your John Lydon.
And he's there with a young labor sympathizing journalist.
I think she's still a teenager.
Yeah, she's very, very young. Jerry Willacy. And so finally, Gorton's, you know, he's, and they all get bundled into the prime ministerial car, and he says, oh, come along, Jerry, come along for the ride. And they all head off to the American embassy. And and Gorton's drunk. The American ambassador they have a kind of bust up over strategy or whatever. The American ambassador starts to get drunk. They refuse to talk to each other. Gorton is basically, all his attention is focused on his lady companion.
Yeah, Jerry. Yeah. So she told her the next day, didn't she? Told her brother, didn't she?
Yeah. So it gets out.
Her brother said, it was an image that stuck with me. 2 a.m., our troops in Vietnam getting killed, and here's the prime minister and the American ambassador getting pissed and refusing to talk to one another. It certainly seemed to me that the prime minister's priority that night was being with Jerry.
And then there was some inappropriate behavior with Liza Minnelli. He met her at a nightclub called Checkers.
Yeah.
And I think he inappropriately touched her.
Like Paul Keating and the Queen.
I think a bit more inappropriate than that.
Oh, dear. This is a real theme of Australian political life, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit French. I mean, it's not up there, really, is it?
But the French wouldn't
behave. Jacques Chirac or anything. But.
Well, it's if you remember, Giscard was accused of groping the buttocks of a German reporter at the age of 112, wasn't he?
Yes.
It's maybe that sort of line of...
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, so he manages to win election in 1969. And the other thing that he does brilliantly is to promote the Australian film industry. So we owe the career Rock and all that kind of stuff.
We owe the film Sir Peter Weir and the career of Mel Gibson to John Gorton. Is that
John
what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, that's something, isn't it? But he loses, doesn't he, in 1971? He's stabbed in the back by his own party. Is this the beginning?
So backstabbing will become an escalating theme.
So they call them leadership spills, don't they? And they absolutely love them. Australians, their MPs love having leadership contests, and toppling each other, and generally the best spills are generally done by people who up till that point have appeared to be very close colleagues and great friends, and then suddenly one of them just plunges the knife.
Well, this is the downside of mateship, is that if it ceases to be elite, then it just goes
wrong,
goes pear shaped. Yeah.
So you know, so Gorton after he lost office. He sort of disappeared or whatever, but he then started doing a radio show called Sir John's Viewpoints. Are you familiar with the radio show? So he would he attacked the granting of property rights to Aborigines. Thought that was a very bad idea. He called for the legalization of prostitution. That is very French. That's very French. Yeah. And he attacked the cacophony known as modern music.
Ah, fair enough.
Which he didn't approve of. Yeah. So he's a character, I think.
And this is before Men at Work. So
or Midnight Oil. So he's succeeded by
the most boring Prime Minister.
Well, is he boring though? You've described him as boring, but I think you've missed some interesting things about him. William McMahon.
So the two things that I noted down.
Yeah.
So he's described in the Australian Dictionary of Biography as a blend of cautious innovation and fundamental orthodoxy.
That's very boring, given
that. That is boring. However, Gough Whitlam, leader of the Labour Party, who we will come to very, very shortly, described him as Tiberius on a telephone.
Yeah.
And Tiberius was notorious for all kinds of shenanigans.
It wasn't
just French behaviour, it was Roman behaviour.
Yeah.
So have your researches in the...
They have.
In the Bodleian.
I've not just gone to the Bodleian, Tom. I've gone to other libraries, other leading libraries.
Okay. So,
and there was a suspicion that hung over. McMahon was very dapper. He was a dandyish man. Mm. And there was a suspicion that hung over him that he was in fact gay, because he got married very late in life. And in fact, yes, at some point he, or his wife, I think, came out and said publicly, he's not a pufter. In those precise terms. So there was that issue. And I think actually, if you go to websites, I mean, obviously, I don't pretend by any means to be an expert, as listeners will know, on Australian history, but websites on Australian kind of LGBT history sometimes say he's Australia's first gay.
Okay. Well, that makes him more interesting then.
But he's also utterly hated by everybody involved with the world of Australian politics.
And he was voted Australia's worst prime minister.
To an extraordinary degree. So there's a veteran Australian political journalist called Laurie Oakes. Do you want to know what he said about...
Yeah, go on.
He's like one of the longest serving kind of observers of Australian politics. He said, my mom was devious, nasty, dishonest. He lied all the time. He lied all the time and stole things.
What did he steal?
He describes this incident where he said McMahon came to his radio station to give an interview. It's such a strange... It's not very French at all. And no French, Valerie Giscard d'Estaing would not stoop to this, and stole a tape recorder.
What? How odd.
He stole a tape recorder, and then when challenged, he said, it's mine, I own it, despite the fact that it had this radio station.
So, not a Napoleon of crime, he was not.
It had the name of the radio station engraved on the machine, but he's like, no, it's mine. I say it's not very French, but that reminds me of something that I think Mitterrand or somebody said about Jacques Chirac, which was... Chirac is a man who, if you found him sitting in your chair eating a big tray of jam tarts with jam all over his face, and you challenge.
They deny.
Sherrod would say, I've never seen any jam tarts. So obviously, this Maman is the equivalent of that.
Yeah. I really take it back.
If he's stolen your tape recorder, he'd deny it.
He's a master criminal. Yeah. He's a master criminal. He's an LGBTQ hero.
He's a poster boy for diversity.
and he's Australia's worst prime minister. So I think, you know, I think we need a break after that, don't we?
We do, because that was far too enjoyable.
And talking of enjoyment, after the break, we come to probably Australia's most entertaining prime minister.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. And definitely the most extraordinary episode in Australian political history.
Definitely.
And so we will return with the premiership of Gough Whitlam.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We promised you excitement, and excitement is coming because we have the premiership of Gough Whitlam upon us. So Gough Whitlam, Tom, is quite a patrician figure, isn't he?
He's a very patrician figure.
He's brought up in Canberra, which had become Australia's capital.
Yeah, under Menzies. So Menzies had really pushed that.
And because his father was a human rights lawyer, the Crown solicitor, and then the Commonwealth Secretary General.
So he's basically Australian royalty.
Yeah. And he's done law at Sydney University, and he's been the
barrister. And he's done classics. Under Enoch Powell, who was, you know, the youngest professor of Greek in the history of the discipline. Yes, yes. So hence the Tiberius on a telephone quip.
Oh, right, yes.
So he knows his Roman history.
But he didn't like Powell's teaching, is that right? Didn't rate it. He thought he was boring.
Yeah.
Whitlam
was never boring. He's kind of dandyish figure. Essentially, you would think that he would be on the right. He would be a conservative. He's a kind of natural Tory, but he isn't. He's on the very much on the Labour side, but he still has the kind of the fondness for dressing up in white tie that you might associate with the kind of the Menzies tradition. So he attends a parliamentary reception in 1954 with the Queen. All the comrades go in their lounge suits, and he goes in white tie and tails.
Well, it's a good way of standing out, isn't it?
It is.
And also, the thing is that if you're a sort of very overtly patrician figure, that can actually play quite well in some ways, in a weird way, with on the left, because you look like an eccentric and you look like a kind of a character.
Well, but also, I think the British parallel would be with Tony Blair.
Tony Blair.
Because by this point, Labour has been out of power for a very, very long time.
Yes, yes.
And essentially, People in the Labour Party are despairing of ever getting back into power, and the party's riven by kind of factional rivalries, arguments over scabs and rats and all this kind of stuff. And I think that Whitlam is able to come in rather like Blair, in that he scrambles the antennae of people in the Labour Party. They can't quite place him, and so he's able to kind of bring in. You know, I mean, he foreshadows New Labour.
Yeah, because he appeals to the. We talked a bit about the suburbanisation of Australian political culture, and I think he appeals to the sort of he brings in some sort of suburban middle class voters as well as the sort of traditional Labour core.
Yeah, and he's very very slick, and he's very good at razzmatazz. In the election campaign that he fights in 1972, he gets a young Australian media magnate who's just setting out on his career to back him, and that is Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
Rupert Murdoch owns The Australian, which is Australia's only national newspaper, and they back Whitlam. And Whitlam has already shown a capacity for taking dramatic and unexpected steps, because even before Nixon does it, and we talked about how Australian politicians often blaze a path for American and British politicians, he goes to China. So he goes to China before Nixon does. He goes to meet Chiu Enlai.
Yeah, which is an extraordinary thing.
Does this influence Nixon? I mean, they must be aware of it.
I think they must be aware of it. Yeah, I don't think it's a conscious, oh my gosh, Gough Whitlam has gone. Because, of course, he's not prime minister when he goes to China, is he? He's Labour leader, but he's not.
But this is still the Cultural Revolution. So the fact that a Western leader has gone.
Exactly. It's a sign of China opening up, I think. I mean, people who know more than me about Henry Kissinger's thinking in 1971 would know more about this. But I don't think it's a, I think it's a straw in the wind, as it were. But I don't think it's necessarily a sort of a massive motivation. But yeah, no, he's a very charismatic figure, isn't he, Whitlam?
Yeah, yeah, charismatic.
He's incredibly fluent and sort of incredibly self-confident. I mean, that's one of the things that brings him down, is that he clearly is not, he's not a man crippled by self-doubt, and he doesn't.
Well, I think he's not a details man, but he's very much a broad brush man.
Yeah.
And he's very good at, rather as Blair did, at kind of capturing a spirit of optimism and regeneration and rejuvenation. And his slogan, it's time.
Yeah.
And it is time.
Well, he does all kinds of, I mean, obviously, as with our previous podcast about German and French leaders, we've been reasonably policy free. Whitlam does, he does things like he abolishes conscription. He pulls the troops out of Vietnam. He has he makes a move towards universal healthcare, which then Bob Hawke will take up again in the 1980s.
Equal pay for women.
Equal pay, exactly. There's sort of Aboriginal. There's a Ministry of Aboriginal Affairs, isn't there?
So he sets that up. Yeah. And so this is, it's under Whitlam that basically white Australia starts to come to terms with the injustices that historically white Australians have done to the native inhabitants of Australia, and he's very hostile to sporting engagement with apartheid South Africa.
Yeah,
because so he's very takes a lead in that.
He's very anti-racist, but partly because of his father's background as a human rights
in the Commonwealth
lawyer.
And in the Commonwealth, Secretary General, and also crucially, he abolishes the sales tax on condoms.
Right. Well, that would go down well with Valerie Giscard d'Estaing.
But you know, the thing that Steve Kinnane was most excited about was that it's Gough Whitlam who gives Edna Everidge her damehood. So
I didn't
Edna
know
Everidge,
she'd been officially awarded this damehood.
Yeah, so this is a film, Barry McKenzie,
right,
in which Barry Humphries stars.
Yeah.
And Barry Humphries, Australian comedian, plays the part of Edna Everidge, who is a housewife superstar, isn't it? What is it? Superstar housewife? What is it?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah, exactly, something like that.
And in the film, she comes back from a tour, and Gough Whitlam is there waiting to greet her and gives her a damehood. And the joke about this is that actually Whitlam has abolished knighthoods and damehoods as being, you know, pommy nonsense.
Yeah, because he's a reformer, he's a moderniser. That is quite Blairite, isn't it? That he's leading Australia into the shiny new future. And then basically, I think, I mean, it's actually typified by, it's so interesting, it happens in October 1973, the Queen opens the Sydney Opera House. And the Sydney Opera House, which everyone forgets now, but at the time, was very controversial.
It was a disaster, wasn't it? Over budget and...
But it's this symbol of modernity, of this shiny modernity. And of course, it's in October 1973 that, as people will know if they've listened to our previous podcasts, the world economy is thrown completely off course. By the Arab-Israeli war, and that Whitlam's whole sort of agenda, which is based on this kind of bright, optimistic, you know, progressive future, is undone by the oil shock
by the need for austerity,
because he's not prepared to countenance. So he doesn't want to deflate the economy as some others do. He doesn't want to raise taxes. He doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to face in some ways the grim consequences of this massive injection of inflation into the world economy.
Well, what he wants to do is to borrow petrodollars, which is, you know, the wealth that's been generated by the sheikhs and so on in the Middle East. But he doesn't want to do it through the middlemen, through the names of Zurich or London or Wall Street or whatever. His minister for energy, the guy called Rex Connor, he says, you know, see if you can find someone who would be able to open up negotiations for us to borrow these 4 billion. You know, kind of, you know, behind the curtain kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so Rex Connor, he finds a middleman who is a Pakistani commodities dealer who is working out of London, Tirath Kemlani, who maybe talks bigger than perhaps he should have done.
Right.
He talks a better game than perhaps he is actually able to execute on the pitch. Because the likelihood, basically, he doesn't have the contacts that he's told Connor that he does. And he seems to have employed his secretary to go around various capitals, sending telexes to give the impression that that Kem Larney himself is there negotiating big deals.
Yeah.
And so it becomes increasingly evident that that he's stringing Connor along. And the opposition and the press start to get wind of this. And by this point, inevitably, Murdoch has turned against Whitlam.
Yeah.
And is starting to sharpen the knife. And Whitlam, who is not a, you know, we said is not a details man, starts to wake up to this. And so in a measure of panic, he revokes the license that Connor had to borrow this money. But Connor continues to try and get the money. And he's staying up all night by the telex machine, waiting for, his ship will come in,
yeah.
But it doesn't. And although Connor stands up and says, I'm an honest man, I wouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. But he has actually, he's still trying to do it, even though he's legally not allowed to. And so this then precipitates the great crisis that undoes Whitlam.
So ever since we started this podcast, Tom, I mean, this whole, the rest is history. Our Australian listeners have been saying to us, will you do the Gough Whitlam story and the fall of Gough Whitlam? Because it obviously looms so large. And look, it's so complicated. All the stuff about the Senate,
yeah.
The two halves of the Senate being elected at different times, and we dissolve half the Senate and all this. But basically the upshot is, isn't it, that
he doesn't have a majority in the Senate.
He doesn't have a majority in the upper house. And the upper house, the Liberals, or the Liberals and their allies have a majority.
Yeah.
And the Liberal leader, a guy called Malcolm Fraser, who we'll come to in a bit, he basically goes for the kill. Sort of twists the knife and is using his majority in the Senate, to block Whitlam's government getting supply, so they can't get anything through.
Yes, which is legal, but no one had ever thought to do it. It had never crossed anyone's mind that this would be an option.
Yeah,
but it's there, it's legal, and so they do it.
So there is a British parallel again, which is what happens to Asquith and Lloyd George at the end of the 1900s, so 1909, 1910. The House of Lords trying to block Lloyd George's people's budget. And you get this massive face-off between the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And it's a little bit like that in the 1970s in Australia.
Yeah. And it's a little bit also like the happens in America, isn't it?
Exactly. Yes, it is. Between the battles between the presidency and Congress. If the Congress and they end up shutting down the government sometimes in America. But obviously Whitlam thinks, Whitlam will not call an election to kind of break the deadlock. He thinks... And this is his confidence, his patrician confidence, I suppose. Even though the government is due to run out of money because it can't get any of its supply bills through, he thinks he can just sort of brazen this out and eventually... So the arbiter, as it were, would normally... Oh, in Britain, it would be the monarch, wouldn't it? But in Australia, it's the Governor General.
Well, so I think there are two reasons why Whitlam is confident. Well, I think there are three. I think the first is that he genuinely feels this is a constitutional outrage.
Yeah.
Secondly, the public is behind him. So 70% of the Australian public regard this, this threat from the Senate as wrong. So he feels he's got public backing. And the third reason is that the Governor General, who is the representative of the Queen as head of state in Australia, is a guy called Sir John Kerr, who Whitlam himself had appointed.
And Sir John Kerr had once been... a Labour Party, I think, member, or at least a very keen supporter. What Whitlam doesn't know is that John Kerr's politics have changed since then.
And also that Kerr is resentful of what he sees as Whitlam's high-handed treatment of him and the way that a lot of Labour MPs laughed him behind his back.
They loved his hair, don't they?
The Liberace of the law, they call him.
Because he's got this sort of very, very white...
Yeah, silver bouffant. Hair.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so basically, Kerr is open to siding with Fraser.
Yeah.
And it's on Remembrance Day, 1975. And Whitlam goes in, so they're running out of money. The guillotine is about to drop. And Whitlam basically goes in to Kerr to say, you've got to sort this out. And Kerr says, you're sacked.
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah.
And Whitlam can't believe it. And rather than kind of laughing at him or telling him to, get on his bike, he walks out and he accepts it. And the moment he's gone out, Malcolm Fraser comes in, swears the oath, and is sworn in as Prime Minister.
And there's an amazing scene outside where someone reads a proclamation saying, Whitlam
God Save the Queen,
and ending with the words God Save the Queen, yeah. which Whitlam had tried to get with, you know, had basically tried to get taken off all the proclamations. And Whitlam is standing there while this happens, and he says, "Well, may we say God Save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General." He gives this very defiant speech,
and the proclamation you've just heard was countersigned Malcolm Fraser, who will undoubtedly go down in Australian history from Remembrance Day 1975 as Kerr's Kerr.
That's very
great
good.
Stuff. Kerr's
Kerr. It's very good. But, I mean, it all turns out disastrously for Whitlam. This is the thing. It's obviously a huge sort of controversy in Australian history, and because a lot of people still think that Whitlam was, it was a constitutional coup against Whitlam, that the CIA were behind it, that the Americans put them up to it, all this sort of stuff. That's John
Whitlam behaves very well. I mean,
but he just takes it, doesn't he?
So he and Bob Hawke, who's very kind of prominent trade union leader who'll become prime minister later on, they both behave very well in that they don't weaponize it because they're worried about imposing too many fracture strains on Australian civic society.
They're the Al Gores of Australian
politics.
But the extraordinary thing is that Whitlam loses that election, because there is an election in December.
Massively.
I mean, Fraser wins a massive landslide.
Yeah, I think the second largest majority in Australian history or something.
And I would assume this is partly a verdict on the fact that the economy is obviously much worse than it had been a few years earlier because of the oil crisis and so on, so this general downturn, but also because people are sick of it's a bit of a get Brexit done kind of atmosphere. They just want it over with. And this is a way to get it over with.
Yeah, maybe.
Do you not think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, I mean, I would guess that it's, pretty much every government that has an election in 1975 loses, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean,
there's an anti-government mood in there.
Yeah, because, you know, in the wake of the oil crisis, everyone's, they're all falling like dominoes. So Whitlam resigns, and he becomes Australia's representative to UNESCO in Paris. So, could be worse fate.
Died at the age of 98.
Yeah, so he's the longest lived Australian Prime Minister. And he became mates with Fraser in the end.
But not with Kerr.
Not with Kerr.
Kerr apparently had to leave Australia.
He ended up in London, and he just used to stag around at gentlemen's clubs.
Yeah.
Drunkenly saying that he'd been wronged.
Well, talking of people staggering around clubs, we now turn to the career of Malcolm Fraser.
Yeah.
So he's a man who I couldn't really picture him because I'm not super familiar with Australian politics. But when I looked him up, he looks like all Australian prime minister. He looks like a casting agency has supplied.
And he sounds like one, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's quite, looks.
I mean, Malcolm Fraser has a Scottish name, but it also sounds quite like an Australian prime minister.
It does. He looks like a sort of big, chiseled, a mate, man's man kind of.
Well, he's the son of a sheep farmer.
He is.
Well, he's a classic Australian. He's the son of a sheep farmer who studies at Oxford.
Magdalen College. Do you know the degree?
No.
PPE.
PPE, well.
Do you want to guess the class?
First.
Third.
Third?
Third.
Okay, so there it is. Son of a sheep farmer, Magdalen, PPE, third.
Yeah. And he's quite pragmatic, isn't he? He's one of those sort of, and in Britain, he would be a sort of Ted Heath-ish kind of figure, I suppose. And his politics, do you think?
Faintly technocratic, I would guess.
Yeah.
Obviously the left hate him. Because they see him as having played. Yeah, he did play his part in this essentially constitutional coup, but he's, he's not in any way a kind of tub thumping right winger.
No.
So the collapse of the White Australia policy is absolutely, he's very happy for the Vietnamese boat people to come to Australia. He behaves very well over that.
And he's prime minister for quite a while, 8 years.
Yeah, yeah. He plays a leading role in opposing apartheid. And then he loses the election in 1983 to Bob Hawke's Labour. And then after he's lost, he goes on foreign travels. In 1986, he goes to America and he visits the fine and fair city of Memphis.
Memphis, Tennessee. And this is the one thing, actually, that basically he'll be remembered for.
Yes.
People outside Australia who are not quite as, like us, who are not massively fascinated by the details of Australian policymaking. And this is by far the signal fact about him, isn't it? So it's the 14th of October, 1986. And Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister of Australia, is discovered in the foyer of the Admiral Benbow Inn in Memphis with no trousers, wearing only a pair of underpants, in a state of some confusion.
And the Admiral Benbow Inn is not the most reputable of establishments.
I think we can say it's downright seedy.
Yeah, it's very, very seedy.
And he has lost, he's lost his Rolex watch worth $10,000, his passport, his wallet, and $600, I think, in cash.
And so there's considerable debate as to what was going on and all kinds of theories.
His wife says this is an absolutely terrible story.
And that he's the victim of a practical joke.
Yeah, a practical joke by fellow delegates at his sort of Commonwealth group meeting. Is that the way that people involved with such groups normally behave, would you say, Tom?
I have no idea. So, I don't know. I don't mix in such rarefied circles.
Very mean-spirited people say that clearly he was visiting a lady of the night and it went horribly wrong. She took his trousers.
Yeah.
But he came downstairs. You know what the concierge said?
No.
She said she remembered him trying to conceal his modesty with a towel. She said, they're not real big. And I remember he was a big man. So, I mean, you could take that as a compliment in some ways.
Yeah. Good old Ozzy. I think that's yet again, so much stuff to say about Australian prime ministers that we're running out of time. So should we go for a third episode?
Yeah, let's do it. Come on.
Because we've got Bob Hawke. We've got
Paul Keating, who's a great character.
Yeah, the Lizard of Oz. and then we've got the kind of basically Game of Thrones bloodletting that is Australian politics in the 2010s.
So the two of you who have made it through to the end of this podcast, you can look forward to a third one in this extraordinary trilogy, as we will be picking up next time with the career of Bob Hawke. G'day.